Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
I'm Andrew McDermott. Today my guest is philosopher of biology Paul Nelson, a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, an adjunct professor in the Master of Arts program in Science and Religion at Biola University. Nelson recently participated in a conference in Cambridge, England, called Evolution Evolving, an international conference on the evolving mechanisms and theoretical framework of evolutionary biology. Paul, thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I mentioned it briefly as we opened there, but why don't you tell us in more detail where you were in early April this year?
Churchill College, Cambridge, hosted an international meeting with the title, as you've mentioned, Evolution Evolving, that was international in the sense that the contributors and the speakers came from really all over the world, not just the UK and the United States, but all throughout Europe, Central and South America. I was quite struck with the degree of international participation at the meeting, which, according to the organizers, was almost immediately oversubscribed. In other words, they announced the meeting and right away all the available slots filled up. Which frankly I found encouraging because the project in which this meeting was yet another chapter or episode, namely the extended evolutionary synthesis, has been heavily attacked by prominent mainstream evolutionary biologists such as Jerry Coyne, Douglas Fatuma, and others as much ado about nothing. They say we don't need an extended synthesis. The textbook theory we have has been working perfectly well for its explanatory tasks. And apparently a lot of people, a lot of younger people especially, are not listening to them because they were eager to be at this meeting, which was held April the 1st through the 4th at Churchill College. And by the way, congratulations to Churchill College. It was a beautifully organized meeting that flowed very, very smoothly. It was really a pleasure to be there.
So did Cambridge organize the meeting and who funded it?
The meeting was organized by two professors at Cambridge, Paul Brakefield, who's a biologist, and Andrew Buskell, who's a philosopher of science. And I'll come back to that, the role of philosophers and historians of science in the extended synthesis has been really amazing. So they were the two local hosts, and then biologist Kevin Leyland and Katrina Falkenberg, one of his co-workers from the University of St. Andrews, were also organizers, and lastly, Tobias Uller from Lund University in Sweden. So they were the five main organizers, and the funding came from the Templeton Foundation, which that funding stream itself creates controversy because onlookers such as Jerry Coyne really don't like Templeton. They think it is muddying the line between science and religion internationally in the kinds of events that it funds. So Templeton provided funding, and also the Galton Institute in the UK, which used to be called the British Eugenics Society. They changed their name in, I believe, 1989. Francis Galton was related to Charles Darwin, a post-Darwinian in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, very interested in what could be done to help evolution, mainly to improve the human stock. And, of course, eugenics has fallen into disrepute in the wake of events in the 20th century. In any case, Galton was another funding organization for the meeting.
Okay. So a beautiful setting and a beautiful time of the year. Why was this conference significant?
Well, I think to answer that question, we really need to go back about four decades or four and a half decades in the history of evolutionary theory in the late 20th century. In the mid-1970s, a group of mostly younger investigators, some of them still in graduate school, others sort of freshly minted PhDs, people like Stephen Jay Gould, Niles Eldridge, Stephen Stanley, really a whole generation of younger evolutionary biologists and theorists, were outspokenly unhappy about the theory that they had learned in graduate school. A classical Neo-Darwinism, or as it's sometimes called, the modern synthesis. And they said, this theory does not solve many of the most important problems in its domain, problems such as the patterns in the fossil record that appeared to indicate not gradual change over time, but discontinuity, patterns of sudden appearance and stasis in the paleontological record. Other biologists who were looking at developmental biology, people like Rudy Raff at Indiana University, who died just recently, were saying, this theory that we learned, this textbook theory, really doesn't handle the phenomena of development. So you have this outspoken disenchantment with the standard theory, which really had dominated biology from the mid-1930s up until the early 1970s. And out of that disenchantment in the late 1970s and early 80s, you have a number of streams of thinking emerge, one of which has come down to us in 2019 in what's now known as the extended evolutionary synthesis. So an easy way to think about this, or a sort of a handle to grasp, is no one looks for a better theory if they're happy with the one they have. So the significance of the meeting, and this Cambridge meeting in April, was organized by some of the same people who organized the 2016 Royal Society meeting in London. The significance comes from unhappiness. And again, I'll say it's like, I don't know if this is really the right metaphor, but I'll use it anyway. If you are dating someone, okay, and you're thrilled with that person, and you can't wait to be with them, and you find all kinds of ways to spend time with them, and you think about them, and you buy them gifts and so forth. In other words, you're just head over heels in love. You're not going to be looking for someone else, right? You're happy with the person you've got. But if you find that you're out to dinner with that person, and you keep stealing glances across the restaurant at another person, or heaven forbid this should happen, but you find you're downloading Tinder onto your iPhone, or some other dating app, right? Because you're looking for more fish in the sea. That's a problem. That's a problem with your relationship. So if we go back to science, if you find that the theory that you were taught, that you've got in your textbooks, that's in the literature, just isn't working for the problems that you're trying to solve, that's a problem. And that will drive you to look for a better theory. So what we see in this Cambridge meeting is that sort of disenchantment. Now, it's a problem for the people within the synthesis, within the extended evolutionary synthesis, because often they are troubled by how they are perceived by people outside that project. They don't want to be told, you're overturning evolutionary biology. They prefer the view of themselves that they're just extending it, hence the name, right? We're extending the synthesis. So it's a real question what they intend to do. Do they want to overturn existing theory, or just make it better?
And it's understandable that they would proceed with caution, although it takes some courage to even step on board a project like this, a research project, as it's been called. But I think it's encouraging to see folks that are willing to stand up, even though they know what scientists can do and the media when you step out of line. It's important to have that courage to say, hey, we need something more here.
I think that's right. And one of the things I really enjoyed about the meeting was the self-awareness among many of the speakers that they were pushing the boundaries. There are certain questions that were really kept off the table during the hegemony of the modern synthesis, such as teleology, bona fide teleology. So when I was at the meeting, a colleague and I presented a poster on orphan genes. That's another podcast. We can't talk about that today. But if you've ever been to a poster session at a scientific meeting, if you've got a co-author, there is a period of the time when the co-author stands by the poster and you're allowed to go wander off and look at other posters. So I did that. My co-author was there and I wandered off to look at other posters, and I was stunned by the number of posters that were addressing forbidden topics, forbidden in the sense that you would never have seen a poster like that at a meeting 30 or 40 years ago under the aegis of the modern synthesis. So right across the aisle from our poster, for instance, was a poster with the title Teleology and Evolution. And I really couldn't believe it. I mean, here is a concept that was supposed to have been driven out of biology more or less permanently by neo-Darwinism. There it is at this extended evolutionary synthesis meeting. So in that respect, I was delighted that the organizers had the courage to allow topics and allow discussion that would not have been permitted under the modern synthesis. And it's a funny thing about starting to look for a better theory. It's hard to know where that's going to end up, right? If you say to people, guess what? We can try some new ideas and we can go back to some old ideas like teleology that everyone thought were shoved off the table or left at the side of the road. It's very difficult to know where that's going to end up. So I'm glad you mentioned courage, because I really admire the organizers for allowing in, at least in the poster sessions, some forbidden topics.
Well, help us understand a little more. What do they mean by extended evolutionary synthesis? Is this one project? Is it multiple lines of inquiry?
It's multiple lines of inquiry. And frankly, one of the critiques of the extended synthesis is that it's incoherent. That is, you have multiple independent projects which are unified really only in being attempts to go beyond the standard theory. Now, a defender of the extended synthesis might say, no, we do have a coherent project. But if you look at the poster session and if you look at some of the talks presented, they're just busting out in every imaginable direction. So you have topics such as non-genetic inheritance, which for an orthodox neo-Darwinian, he would say, well, look, there just is no such thing. The only thing that matters for evolutionary transformation is permanent change, and the only way you can get that is if you change DNA. So he or she would say non-genetic inheritance is just a misnomer or an oxymoron. But there are other lines of inquiry that are heterodox, that are really breaking from the standard theory, such as environmentally induced phenotypes, where the listeners might know this as a Lamarckian or neo-Lamarckian change. Again, heresy within the standard theory, but a proponent of an environmentally induced phenotype that is permanent, in other words, that makes a permanent evolutionary change, that person might say, well, look, it's possible that the environment causes changes in a species, in a population, that in a sense lead natural selection. According to the standard view, genetic mutations are acted upon by selection, and it's only after they're filtered by selection that they become permanent. This view says, actually, it's the environment acting directly on the phenotype that, in a sense, tells the population which mutations are going to be passed on, or in fact, anticipates mutational change. And I'll tell you, I find a lot of these ideas quite hard to absorb, because I'm skeptical about the quality of the evidence that's adduced in their support. But I'm intrigued by the fact that people want to talk about this. So in a nutshell, the extended synthesis is looking at all the parts of evolutionary theory that were regarded as minor or insignificant during the hegemony of the modern synthesis. So we're talking roughly from the mid-1930s right up until really the end of the 20th century. And these younger, mostly younger proponents of the extended synthesis are saying, we pushed to the side of the road a lot of interesting mechanisms and processes that may have an important role in evolution, and we need to reconsider those. And I can't list them all here within the space of this podcast, but in a couple of companion articles that I'll be writing for Evolution News and Views, I will provide links to the work of some of these authors so interested listeners can follow up in greater detail.
Oh, okay. That sounds great. Well, some leaders in the EES, such as biologist Kevin Leyland, complain that other evolutionary biologists or intelligent design advocates have distorted the EES, seeking to magnify controversy around it. How do you respond to that?
Well, let me go back to my dating metaphor from a few minutes ago, because I think in many ways it's fitting. You're dating somebody, and I'll take the role of the male who's head over heels in love. And I look across the table at my girlfriend. She's not looking at me, right? She's looking around the restaurant. In particular, she's looking at a guy sitting on the other side of the room. And I can't help but notice she's paying attention to him and not to me. So I say, hey, I'm here, right? Eyes front, I'm here. Why are you looking at him? And she denies it, right? She says, oh, I was just distracted, never mind. Well, let's be honest. Anyone in a relationship that, you know, they've been in a relationship for a while, they know when their partner is paying attention to them and really, really devoting himself or herself to the relationship. And they know at a gut level when that person is not. So I think what happens with the extended synthesis is onlookers, people who are not directly involved in the project, can see that the members of the extended synthesis are visibly unhappy with the standard theory. They're looking around the room for something better. And when it's called to their attention, it's a little bit disingenuous for them to say, oh, we're just trying to expand the theory that we currently have, you know, fill out some of the details, make it a little richer. You know, you read their work. And in particular, I'll give you an example. In 2016 at the Royal Society meeting, which was an earlier chapter in the development of the extended synthesis, Gerd Müller from the University of Vienna opened the meeting on Monday morning with a stunning critique of standard theory. And the problems that he listed were not minor side points like, oh, we failed to address this little puzzle over here, and there's a minor problem that needs a bit more attention. The challenges that he listed were right in the center of what evolutionary theory needs to explain, such as the origin of novelty, the origin of adaptive complexity, and so forth. So when someone like Kevin Leyland says, well, this is all being distorted by people from the outside, I think he needs to be more candid about the actual unhappiness and disenchantment among his extended synthesis colleagues. Like I said before, no one goes looking for a better theory if they're happy and satisfied with the one they have. So yes, I think it's important to be accurate, and I will be providing links in my companion articles to pieces by Kevin Leyland where the listener can see for himself or herself why Leyland is unhappy. But my guess is, if I have to prognosticate, 10 years from now, when people look back on this extended synthesis project, they'll say, well, I can see why they were so unhappy, because here's where things ended up. So bottom line for me, I pay attention to what people do much more than what they say. And if what you do is write articles complaining about the failure of the standard theory to solve the problems in its domain, that's what I'm going to pay attention to.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you about the future of the synthesis here, and you've addressed that. One short final question before we close here. Where does intelligent design fit into this?
Well, intelligent design lies outside all of this. And the reason for that is the extended synthesis is still within what Ann Gager and I call the city of naturalism. You can imagine this like a medieval town with a surrounded by a high wall, impassable wall, actually. And naturalism defines the boundaries of what's permissible within evolutionary theory for really everybody within the extended synthesis. Intelligent design violates that. Intelligent design says that the toolkit of science goes beyond really processes and mechanisms derived ultimately from physics, that we recognize the reality of intelligence as a real cause in nature. So in a sense, we are watching all this happen, to stay with the city of naturalism image. We're watching it happen from a distant hillside. We're looking down into the city of naturalism and we see what's going on. And the extended synthesis is still within that city. So my encouragement, and I was able to have a few conversations with people at Cambridge, the thing that I would encourage them to do is to work up the nerve to go outside the city of naturalism. And there's a wonderful, beautiful territory beyond those walls that they need to consider.
Yeah. Well, Paul, thanks so much for taking the time to explain this to us. I look forward to talking further about this in the future.
Thanks again for having me, and I look forward to joining you again for another one of these discussions.
Well, as mentioned, look for written coverage of the Evolution Evolving Cambridge Conference from Paul Nelson shortly at evolutionnews.org. That's our flagship news and commentary site, evolutionnews.org. Listen to more episodes of ID the Future on the web at idthefuture.com or find it through your favorite podcasts app. For ID the Future, I am Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
From jumping insects with real gears to the strange world of carnivorous plants, the details of the natural world reveal planning and purpose. In his new book, Foresight, Brazilian scientist Marcos Eberlin shows how the mantis shrimp can pack a deadly punch and how a tiny protein in a bird's eye may work just like a GPS. You can join Marcos Eberlin as he uncovers a myriad of artful solutions to major engineering problems in chemistry and biology. Find out how these solutions point beyond blind evolution and point instead to the designing ability of a mind, and a mind with foresight. Order on Amazon or visit discoveryinstitutepress.com to get your own copy of the book Foresight. Get Eberlin's new book from Amazon or at discoveryinstitutepress.com/foresight.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.